of Ways and Means Natural Resource Committee to order. First of all, I apologize to you folks that have been waiting. There was just a lot of issues we had to work through unrelated to this budget in the hallway before we came in. So here we are. With that, I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5521, Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Mr. Siebert, would you give us an overview?
Certainly. At your places, hopefully you brought with you the memo I passed out Friday. Orientation and background memo.
Challenged at keeping up with our paperwork. Do you have any ideas? Thank you.
That be this
one? Yes, that would be. Attached are a number of items, the first of which is a very brief agency overview that describes the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries' mission and purpose, which I'm sure the agency will get into more detail on. Also gives some graphic displays on the governor's budget, which I know that BAM will cover more. And a brief history of support for the department over time, starting with the 91-93 biennium up to the present governor's budget. Also attached is a copy of the analysis of the governor's recommended budget. There were no budget notes in the agency's budget last time. There was a statement of expectations, which I attached, dealing with publication costs and costs charged. There were no audit reports. There was one interim study, which is also attached, on efforts to secure funding for modeling of future earthquake losses in Oregon. There's one fee adjustment proposed in the governor's budget for the mine land reclamation program. I've attached a copy of that House Bill 2256, which contains this fee increase. And finally, the emergency board actions pertinent to the department. And copies of the minutes are also attached.
Thank you, Paul. Would the department like to come forward? Good if you told us what you're going to be working off of. Is it this book or this book or this?
And what page?
Mr. Chair, I'd say I'm going to be working off of probably the light-colored blue, but I'll also be speaking initially at a governmental level that we won't need to get into that for a little while. Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here. My name is John Bolio. I'm a state geologist. I'd like to introduce some of the people with me today. First of all, in no particular order, Gary Lynch is the Assistant Director for Regulation.
Which one is he?
I would, just by means of introduction, he's the fellow whose program, after 2 years of effort, finally managed to secure funding through the paper jungle of government, I guess, and to fix a very unstable part of the Rogue River so that now it has fish where before it had none. But I would go beyond that to point out that in 1992, his program received a national award for the best reclamation in the United States. And in that case, they had fixed a stream in northeast Oregon that had been basically destroyed by mining. But the river now is primarily fixed with voluntary efforts and is better condition now than it was before man discovered it in the first place. So he fixes rivers.
How do you know that?
You can do it by water quality testing, for example. And some of the pictures on that appear in the strategic plan, which you received earlier, and I believe it's probably in this document as well. Here we go. We're already getting into detail. But let me continue with the introductions. Also with me, if you've ever flown the North Pacific you're safer today than you would have been a few years ago, because Dr. Vicki Todd, whose job it was, made it safer for you. She studied the volcanoes of the Aleutians and made recommendations to the Federal Aviation Administration on how to route and time flights. And the thing that interested me when she was recruiting for her first job with us was that she had great temptation to wander off into all sorts of esoteric stuff, but instead stuck to those things that are of greatest use to the client and to the safety of people. And that particular theme running through her activities made her a very good candidate for our department, because that's what we try to do. Also with me, or with us today, is Charles Kirby, head of the business office. He was recruited specially some years ago because I needed talent beyond counting numbers. I needed a person that could give me a tracking system for costs that was simple enough for geologists to understand, and also a means of projecting what our revenue position was into the future 3 years so we could build a budget. So with his help, we have financial projection sheets that track well with a very complex array of contracts that come and go and have all sorts of different conditions, and we can actually say where we are. And then lastly, you may recall last session, there was a discussion in the legislature about the nature of this department being a public service non-regulatory branch of government that helps people solve problems for themselves. But in order to do that, we are going to have a bigger board and more interaction with the public. Based on that, we went from a 3-member board to a 5-member board, and we wrote a new strategic plan. With us today is chairman of our board, Don Christensen. He's also on the Marine Board. So those are the people with us. I guess my first assignment is to talk about the mission of the department. And what I'd like to do is, if you'll permit me, is to digress through a historic anecdote that I think captures a lot of what we're here for, and then I'll get down to the bottom line as to why the state should have a geology department. In 1969, I was sitting in the faculty room at the University of Oregon, and we had placed in front of us a vial of black little chips of rock. And these rocks had just been brought back from the moon, and we were being asked to explain what they were and how they got the way they were. And I was very puzzled. They're very strange rocks, and I won't get into all that, but I was puzzled why we were being asked this in the state of Oregon to deal with moon rocks. And I came shortly thereafter to work for the University, for the Department of Geology, and I discovered in 1965 that our agency and the University of Oregon had worked together to train the first moon landing crew on how to walk on basalt without ripping their suits. And they were very indebted to us for that. In fact, they took a piece of moon rock up to the moon and left it there, took a picture of it, and we published it in our old magazine, Oregon Geology. Well, the upshot of all that effort was that there was not only a training exercise on the basalt flows of eastern Oregon, but there was also a coming together of the international community on the understanding of certain kinds of volcanic rock. And we produced this bulletin. You'll see that it's held together by clips. This is a collector's item. You don't find these very often. It talks about a certain kind of rock, and you think it's incredibly esoteric. But fate would have it, in 1980, when Mount St. Helens blew up, the question was, what's going to happen here in Oregon? Because there are certain types of activity on some of our volcanoes as well. And we were able to take this information and to calm the public and to say to them that we may, in fact, have eruptions in the future, but if we do, they won't be like Mount St. Helens, or at least they probably won't be. Fast forward to 1999, 2000, we start to have volcanic activity, a swelling underneath South Sister that's about 10 or 15 miles in diameter and has risen about 4 to 5 inches in the last 4 or 5 years. It's on scale with collection of data like this in other areas like Alaska, where volcanic eruptions eventually have occurred. It's probably on scale with places where they haven't occurred as well. The point I would make here is that we did a very obscure study in 1965 as a geology survey for the public good, and it served us well, not necessarily in waving our arms and saying there's disaster ahead. It served us better in these cases of calming the public and settling down the U.S. Geological Survey people who have been going around saying things more extreme than we have. But it really gets interesting because out of this publication comes an understanding that some of the flows that did come off South Sisters extended all the way into and through Eugene. And I find this to be fascinating because the discovery, the discussion last summer that talked about should there be a gravel pit north of Eugene and in which at least $2 million was invested in legal fights and permitting revolved in part, a very small part, around understanding some of the geologic units in those future pits. And those units happen to be mudflows coming off of South Sister. So I think it's fascinating how geology, if it's done correctly, is of value.
I have to break in there, John. You're not making... If I lived in Eugene, I wouldn't feel real secure with those statements. How soon can we expect another move into Eugene?
I don't intend to worry about it in my life. Okay. It's important to know.
I'd like to also point out there are some people in this room that are considering that as something to look forward to.
No. Senator Fresh, I was going to say that, so I'm better of it.
Well, I would say that, Mr. Chairman, if you're in Deschutes County and have the kind of eruptions that you do there, you do have a good tourist attraction coming up because they're very limited in scope and they're beautiful to look at. Hawaii has lots of people coming to visit.
Mr. Sheriff, I might. Did I hear you say, Mr. Bolio, that there was a bulge developing on South Sister right now?
Satellite imagery shows a bulge of about 10 to 15 miles in diameter, increasing at 2.5 centimeters a year at a steady pace since 1997. And it continues. There have been speakers from the U.S. Geological Survey Volcanic Observatory going into Bend talking about this, and it's been in the press quite a bit in that part of the state. I inquired as to the magnitude of these types of displacements compared to other places where the same technology had been used, and I was told by the individual in the survey that the two other times he has seen this happen, he has seen a volcanic eruption. We would go on to say that this is a very new technology, and there are other places where we know it probably hasn't happened, and so it's too early to get excited. But it is being monitored. We do not have a volcano program in the department. We don't intend to have one. It's our role to work with the Volcanic Observatory and help them translate their information to the public so it's not alarmist, but it's still accurate.
May I?
Representative Martin.
I'm interested in this. Who's measuring it right now?
U.S. Geological Survey, Volcano Observatory. If we want to pursue this at length, it's probably best if I have Vicki McConnell answer some of these questions. She's working
One more question. Is the bulge, is it accelerating or staying? Is the rate
it's
static over
steady
time?
Steady state at this point. Steady state at this point.
I'm not sure that has anything to do with our budget, but if you could supply us with some information, it'd be very interesting.
Vicki?
May I interject one quick bit of information? If you go to the USGS website and look for the Cascade Volcano Observatory, they have a page dedicated to all of the different volcanoes, and the information, you can go right to the Sisters, the South Sisters, and it'll give you updated information on what they're measuring and the latest stuff.
Then may I request, Mr. Chair, that rather than having her spend her valuable time doing that, that we could just go to this website.
Thank you.
I'm trying to get to a more fundamental point.
We're sidetracking you here.
Okay. Well, the point I would get to with all of this is that in this particular case, the international community came to our assistance in the preparation of this bulletin that's been of use for us. And there have been many examples in the past 10 years where we've also gone to the international community and assisted them because our advice has been solicited the other way. The bottom line is geology is incredibly difficult to do. It is very, very difficult to make meaningful maps or to interpret with credibility what's going on. And the question has to be, why are we doing this? What is the fundamental purpose of a geology department? And I'm kind of interested in this. I've been tracking it as a matter of interest for years. And it's interesting to me that every single country on this planet that has any measure of stability has a geology department or something like that. And proud to say that 126 of them have some of our publications. It's also of interest to me that every single state has a geology department. most of them funded far more generously than we are. And so the reason is why, and I have three reasons that come to mind over the weekend as I ponder this. The reason there are geology departments is that they're, first of all, one of the few areas where you can have non-regulatory government make a difference. Secondly, we have geology departments to help the general public in the only way that is cost-effective to avoid the losses of large-scale disasters. And this does not necessarily mean regulation. It means educating the public so they know what to do. There's just no other way to do it. A third reason we have a geology department is because if geology is properly understood and properly used, the savings to society can be immense. They're all secondhand. They're mostly invisible, but they can be immense. In 1996, we were asked to do a benefit-to-cost analysis for our department, and at that time, we actually had an economist on board, and the number was 235-1. Every dollar going into our department resulted in a rationalized $235 in savings. Now, we haven't been able to update that report because the economist got laid off. He's gone. But it still basically fits the agency. And then the final reason that we have geology departments, as I'm rambling here for 10 minutes, actually escapes me at the moment. See what I wrote down here. I've lost it for the moment, but anyway, we have the disaster avoidance, we have the cost avoidance. Well, we also have, and this is actually fairly important too, there are immense opportunities for the economy. And I'm not just talking mine sites. That's usually the first one that people come up with. When you start a new country in a frontier area, the first thing people want to do is make money, so they have a geology department go out and subsidize the mining industry. But as you get further along, there are other applications for that, and you'll find that under tab 8. In a letter to Jim Brown, because he asked the Natural Resource Agencies to please give him some ideas for an economic stimulus plan, and we provided him with 8 ideas, or 8 or 9, for everything from assisting with geologic background as it helps groundwater discovery and management in rural areas, to using geology to trim the costs on any strategy for seismic rehabilitation, because it is possible to use information to reproduce to bring the cost of such efforts into manageable limits. So I could go on, of course, but I think I've made the general case as to why we have geology departments, and I've given an example on how it's tracked over the years. I would close with an observation that I'm not sure I'm correct on, but I'd like to at least start it in your thinking now, and then we'll get back to it later. There's only so much money that you can percolate through a geology department and have it work. And I'm convinced that we can certainly meet the obligations of the governor's balanced budget, but if there are to be further reductions in the form of fund shifts, I want to work with my staff and with legislative fiscal to make sure that it is mechanically possible to spend more money on the staff that I now have, because people can only work on one contract at a time. They can't work on contracts between contracts. Some of the people are used as match, and some of the people are used for those public service functions that are more properly funded by general fund, and they simply can't be pulled off of those. And I'm thinking of some of the things that I described this morning. There's nobody going to fund us to go to Bend and settle the troops after somebody from another agency has gone there and screwed things up too much, for example. There are some things we just simply have to do for the public good. So I'm edgy about the funding, obviously, and you'll hear that from everybody that talks to you this year, I'm sure. And I think that's about as far as I want to go with mission and with purpose of the agency, unless there are questions.
Any questions? Let's get into the meat of things.
Okay. What is the next order of business here?
Are you through with your...
We, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've received quite a variety of instructions on how to proceed here. And as of last Friday at 1:40, we were giving 4 bullets. One was why the agency exists. Two was how are we performing? 3 was, how do we use our budget? And 4 was, what would be the outcomes if our budget were funded? Now, if that's how we want to proceed today, then what I would like to do would be to invite Dr. McConnell up here, because she's lead on the performance measure tracking for the department. That's probably the best way to track the second, go after the second bullet. Is that the pleasure of the board or the committee?
You bet.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the Deputy State Geologist for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. What I would like to do now is describe a little bit about how we use our performance measures and how we employ both the benchmarks and performance measures for tracking our efficiency and productivity. And so what I have are, well, there's a couple of places you can look as we move you through all of these books. If you look in your budget document, the actual budget summary on page 79, you'll see of the agency's narrative summary, you'll see a quick description of our performance measures, and also the summary, they're all put in tables, and there's a summary there as well, plus an evaluation from the the Oregon Performance Board. And I would also like to pass out, if I may, just the graphic representation of our summary for the performance measures.
Let me ask you this, Vicki, will you also be prioritizing your programs? I think as I talked to John and the co-chairs are very, very much insisting on prioritizing by not only in your programs, but in the sense that should we have further reductions to make, or should we have more revenue than we anticipate? Either way, that we can either have a guideline to reduce budgets or a guideline to enhance budgets.
excuse me, Senator Mezzali, Chair, and members of the committee. I will turn that part of the discussion back over to John. What I want to do now is just quickly go through how we have our strategies and our goals set up. And if you'll turn to the page, it's on the links to Oregon benchmarks. It's at the back of the handout. And what this does is it gives you an idea of how we use our performance measures, both toward the roll-up, toward the Oregon benchmark program, and then the performance measures that are not part of the benchmark program, but are part of our internal strategies and goals.
Okay, now what page are we on?
That's in the back of your handout. It'll be third from the back. It says the links to Oregon benchmarks. I think it has a page 1 on it.
Okay. It's also in our book, too.
Yes, it is. We want to make sure you have this information.
Okay.
We have had the opportunity in the performance measure and setting up our performance measures to actually be able to relate part of our mission goals and strategies to the Oregon benchmark program, and in particular to benchmark 67, which is to determine the to help the Oregon communities and counties and communities with hazard data and with hazard mitigation. And in particular, we have in the Department of Geology 3 primary geologic hazards that we consider important to be both characterizing and helping with communities to educate themselves for mitigation. And those are all part of our number one goal, our first goal there, which is reduce risk to Oregonians from naturally occurring geologic hazardous events. Now, there's plenty of hazards out there that aren't geologic of nature, and we certainly don't claim that we're the experts on them.
In particular, though, we have been working with coastal communities for tsunami hazards maps and mitigation plans. We've also been working with all the communities in the state, and in particular the western side of the state, for landslide hazard maps and mitigation plans. And then, again, working with the entire state, looking at communities, what we create ground response maps, which is really in response to earthquake hazards, and then mitigation plans. And I would like to bring your attention also to our organizational chart right now, that we have put this nice colorful chart for you up. And the reason I do that is because the way that we set up our organization is a series of sections. They're theme or field-oriented sections. For example, on the far left-hand side, we have the Eastern Oregon and the Southwest Oregon section, which means those are field offices that are in those field areas. They are primarily concerned with dealing with the geology or the geologic hazards in those areas. We also have a coastal section, which of course deals with coastal, and we have a mapping and a mineral section. Now, that looks, on one hand, that you would have these individual sections and you wouldn't have a lot of crossover. And what I want to bring your attention to now is that when we look at our goals and strategies and our performance measures, we look at the crossover between how we can accomplish these goals within these particular sections. And if you, for example, if you look at your second chart, the tsunami chart here, you'll notice that when we are following how we are performing in tsunami mitigation and in tsunami characterization, there are actually two lines to follow there. And one of those is because one of them is for the actual identification and characterization, which means the map making. Going out in the field, finding where that problem is, mapping it, and looking at how you can deal with it. And then also within that is looking at how you can model that.
Excuse me. Representative Johnson.
I apologize for interrupting you. I just didn't realize it was going to work quite like this. Ordinarily, I'm a pretty big fan of local offices, just because I think there's a connection between folks and people in public service helping them. But with a small agency like this one and as many field offices as you described, have you looked at all about how cost-effective it is to have a few people scattered all over the state rather than the opportunity for them to work in a more centralized office and perhaps share some responsibilities?
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Johnson, well, that's an excellent question. And when you look at it from the first layer of saying, okay, if you have your people together where they can share, for example, they could maybe share administrative staff, et cetera.
One map-making machine or one GIS or replication.
And that does work okay, except then you have the problem of you have to pay somehow for those people that are in the field to get them back out in the field to actually do their field work. And so what we found is that in the long run, having to pay exorbitant prices to put people in the all over the state mapping because they would all be living in Portland, and we'd still have to be paying maybe as long as six months of the year for them to be living elsewhere to be doing their field work, that in the long run, for just the mapping, the field work part of it, it's better to have your small offices set up. And we don't have a lot of replication when it comes to, for example, we only have one public ed and one cartography department, which is in the main office in Portland. So when our mappers, when our geologists that are in the field surveys or the field areas, when they complete their draft maps, that's turned over. There's not a whole public ed, and there's not a whole mapping department out there. That's turned into the main office. So we still have a considerable amount of sharing of our primary support staff within these field offices.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Just to continue on, the point that I that I was making there, and that I think that that is a good thing to think about, is that, you know, is it cost effective to have them in the field, is that we have found that it's better to keep a field presence when we're doing our actual mapping and characterization. We've also found that it's better to have a field presence because we are more in tune then with what the issues are in certain areas, and certainly across the state the issues are extremely varied, both for geologic and for mitigation issues. And I think just if you look at the three issues between landslides, tsunamis, and earthquakes, where you have areas of those that are both concentrated and not concentrated, become very important. If you look back to the summary chart again, on the second, on the back page of that, we have our performance measures that are not directly linked to the benchmark 67, but are directly linked to our mission statement and our strategies. The first to those, goal three, relates directly to our mine land reclamation program one, and really are ways that we can monitor how successful we are in both parts of that, which are returning mined acres to some secondary environmentally compatible and beneficial use. And John mentioned briefly that was some of the restoration work that was that has been done, and also active mining acres that are under regulation and review, and more importantly, that are bonded, securely bonded. If you have specific questions about those parts of the program, I would ask you to direct them to Gary Lynch, the director of Program 1. Goals 4, there are three parts of Goals 4, which really involve our primary mapping and mineral resources sections. And again, we have great crossover here. We do have a mapping and mineral resource section, but then all of our field sections also have geologists, they'll have mappers, they'll have regional mappers within them that may well work on a program or a project that's within the mapping program. We look at characterizing the geologic data and compiling that data to solve land use issues, watershed issues, land use issues, etc., both on a regional and a local level. We don't do site characterizations, but we do look at relatively high-resolution mapping problems. We have learned through evaluating our performance measures over the last few years that we need to change some of our strategies, and this is one of the ways that performance measures have worked very well for us, is that by looking at some of the results of those and looking at where the issues are, we were able to change our primary direction in map making from a higher resolution, looking at 1 to 24,000 or 7.5-minute quads, to more regional mapping, and in particular looking at watershed basins. So this was a learning experience for us, and one that we pulled directly from some of our evaluations. And if you look at goal 5, which is the performance measure 10, it's also performance measure 5. And what this is looking at our improving our public awareness and our geologic output from the work that we've done. And this is the primary function of our public ed and outreach section, although they are heavily tied in with any of the other projects or sections that we have. And there's one thing that I would like to stress: whenever you're working on any kind of a scientific project or any kind of a map, be it geologic or otherwise, you can gather data all day long. You can gather it for months and years, and you can compile it together. But until you can get that information out in some form that's usable to whoever ultimately your audience is, it's not worth the time and the trouble it took to go that far with it. And so we really work very hard in our public ed and outreach department or section, works very hard to be able to craft their information into a usable format
for whomever our audience is at the time.
So, Vicki, may I ask, are these prioritized then as we, these agency numbers, or how do they relate to the performance?
The list is not prioritized in, I would say that the list is not prioritized. The list is basically that we developed it to first show the ones that links to the Oregon Benchmark Program and then really just set the rest of those up. But no, they are not in any priority.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Duke.
How often do you use a private polling company?
Senator Dukes, chair of the committee, I can't honestly answer that because the polling, we have ceased using that polling, and that's why we say that we're under development for looking at a way to evaluate the efficiency and the effectiveness of our public outreach. I'm not sure, but I don't think it was more than once a year, maybe once a biennium, to look at it, to use that as our evaluation technique.
What kinds of questions did you ask them?
I would have to say was that we would have asked them to design a questionnaire package to use as their poll at random. And I was not part of that. I do not like to say that, but I honestly was not part of how that was set up, so I can't give you a definite answer on that. I do know that we, as we said in our narrative, we really found that it was diminishing returns on the information that we were receiving back from that, and that's why we decided that it was not really cost-effective or information-effective.
Senator, Representative Krueger.
Mr. Chair, the agency did some work with the Forestry Department, I believe, on high-risk sites, debris flows, and is that mapping complete on that portion?
Representative Krueger, members of the committee, no, that mapping is not complete if you're asking specifically about the Senate Bill 12 mapping. Yeah. Where we are right now in that process is we have rescinded our rules that we were going to release a map that was specifically linked to Senate Bill 12 as of the first of this year. Rules have been rescinded that would have required that and would have required the cities and counties involved to begin their 10-month moratorium. What we are doing is releasing that information, that map, as an IMS, which is an interpretive map series map, IMS 22, and it should be out in February. But it will not be linked to Senate Bill 12. Why I'm saying this is because it's a good map. There's great information there, but it does not need to be linked to that particular that bill right now. There's some more information and issues that we'd like to see covered in with that. But we do want to get that information out, and so we're releasing that first map as one of our IMS series maps.
Thank you.
Proceed.
I think for giving you an overview on how we use performance measures and the benchmark, the Oregon benchmark that we have specifically built our performance measures around, that this is, I have the overview and you have the overview. I do want to say just a couple of things that we use these performance measures to help us in a couple of ways. As I was saying before, we are able to use them to evaluate how effective, not necessarily by pure productivity, but how effective our work is and how efficiently we can operate. And I would bring your attention to two of the graphs in the handouts that I gave on pages 6 and 7. What you're looking at, the reclamation 1A and 1B,
And if you'll notice over in the 1999-2000 section on both of those graphs, there are some large jumps there. For example, in the first one, looking at areas reclaimed, we actually have a drop, an apparent drop in the amount of areas that are being reclaimed. And if you look on the second one, 1B, you'll see this, you'll see a big jump in the active mining acres under regulation. Now, the reason that you see those apparent changes, which looks like that suddenly we're not reclaiming any acreage, or we're really dropping in the reclamation, is because Program 1 instituted a different way of measuring the acreage that are in these disturbed sites. And as what they had done is they had started taking aerial photos and using aerial photos in GIS, Geographic Information System software, to determine the surface area or the acreage that are actually disturbed. And in doing that, in improving our technology, we realized that we had, in one case, overestimated the areas that were out there, and in the other case, underestimated. And it became very apparent when we did our performance measure at the end of the year. So these are ways that we use not only to be able to say, oh, these graphs are always going up, which means overproductive, but more importantly, to show if they're actually being effective or efficient.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
do you have any performance measures that relate to customer satisfaction, whether how complaints are dealt with expeditiously or not expeditiously, or how quickly people go through permitting processes? Is there anything to relate to any of that kind of stuff?
Representative Morgan, members of the committee, we don't track that specifically. And actually, you actually asked. pardon me, I'm hearing a little.
Gary Lynch is having a.
Yeah, I was. I would like to turn that question over to some of my learned colleagues, if you would permit me to do that.
If you want to pull up another chair here, and you can just.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and my name is Gary Lynch, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And to Representative Morgan's question, and just a couple of the Mineland. The MLRR program is program 2, and we may be confusing there a little, but anyways, in the program 2, we do track the number of complaints, and there are several, and we break them into categories, depending, and not that we treat them different, but some is the public calling, and they have a complaint about the way the mining activity is going, or are we getting complaints from miners that the permitting is taking too long. The answer is I actually have the number right here. We received 29 complaints last year.
But it's not tracked as part of your performance measure stuff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, it's tracked within MLR, but it's not tracked at this time in the performance measure stuff. Anyways.
Paul, could you make a note that when we talk about the performance measures, could we bring up the customer satisfaction issue?
I would also be very interested in, I think you mentioned that you might even have this, in the types of complaints and how many of each one were in each category, and then the resolution as well, so we know if they were valid complaints or whether there was a permit infraction, exactly what we're dealing with. That's something I think not only the co-chairs but the general public is asking us to hold all departments accountable for.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that internally we're doing that to a degree. We can do a better job, and in fact we have talked that our monthly report needs to better define and frankly make it easier for everybody to see just what's happening. And we're in program 2, I might add, that's a little easier to do only because we have a certain number of permits, we have a certain number of complaints, and it's easy to track, but it should be no problem.
Follow up?
Well, I'm just thinking, we should kind of
have that same kind of discussion that we had this morning to warn people that we're kind of in a mode here where we've been given directions to do budgets in ways that we've never done them before. And when we were in the education sub this morning, we were working on the state library and trying to give them the feeling that we're all trying to grasp the process here. And so as we kind of launch into these discussions, please bear in mind that we are not targeting the DOGAMI in the discussions. A lot of this is just going to be our attempt to try to figure out how we're dealing with information in the global sense of the task that we have.
John wants to speak to this. And we need four chairs.
There we go. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wonder if I might even round out the answer to this question a little bit further. In Program 1, for a number of years, we did, in fact, make attempts to track customer satisfaction. And this was prior to Vicki's time, and it wasn't something that Gary was particularly involved with. And we had polls out there. And polls are tricky. Sometimes they're scientific and sometimes they aren't and all this stuff. And they're expensive to do right. And as Vicki pointed out, we found out it was not really, we just didn't feel like we were getting meaningful information. But among other things, we had, in any of our transactions with the public, we were putting forms, everything we sold, stuff like this, we had forms sitting on the desk down at our public service center. And people could fill those out. And they could say, you know, how do you feel about things, whatever. And we were always really proud to report that, gee, 98% of people are happy with what we're doing. But the ones that are happy are the ones that fill out the form. So you have to kind of think these things through. And then when I stopped doing that, or when other people stopped doing it, and then our last deputy, Dennis Olmsted, came aboard, he had the same conclusion that we were certainly doing a good job accounting, but we didn't know what it meant. Seemed like it was biased. Just the setting of filling it in seemed biased, and it seemed like it was splintered. And so he chose to kind of put a placeholder in our performance measures and say, we're going to have to figure this out. We don't quite know how to count it yet. And then Vicki took over, and she elevated the issue, I believe, to a benchmark placemark. You know, it's a benchmark status for experimental study at this point, and we're going to have to figure out how to do this. Now, to get to some of the specific comments of the subcommittee here, what did people say? Sometimes it's more important what they said than how many said it. I mean, we can have a million people out there happy, and they're not going to say much, but then the one person who's unhappy might have something very instructive to tell us. And so one thing that occurs to me is maybe whatever we do, kind of do more of what Gary says he's doing down in Albany, and that is to keep track of what was wrong. And the measure might not be some mathematical 70% of people are happy. The measure might be when somebody's unhappy, what do you do about it? And in that case, you want a comments column and a resolution column, which is how the governor's office handles correspondence that comes to them. Sometimes they send to us. So we're struggling with that, and we know where we've been has left us with the impression that we could certainly give you good numbers, but we're not sure they would mean much.
I might add, John, that I think my colleagues here would agree with me. Oftentimes I'm asked by personnel and department heads, what do I want to see, or what makes me happy, I guess is the way they put it. My response is always, I'm happy if I don't get any complaints. And so I think you're in line there. I mean, if you're doing your job and we're not getting, as legislators, we're not getting feedback that there's dissatisfied people, I think that's the kind of identification we want here, exactly what you said. If there is a problem, we want to know, first of all, what it is, how prevalent is it, what are the impacts of it, and how are you handling it?
I think we can handle that and deal with it, and Vicki will do a fine job. She'll figure out how to keep track of this stuff, and we'll get better answers for you.
And I might add that we really need that kind of information prior to our work session. Not sure how soon that will be, but that will be part of our decision-making here with our budgets.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can report to you
off the top of my head, in the 25 years I was deputy director, and in the four that I've been director, I have received a complaint from the public on behavior of my staff probably once or twice. And I'd have to think you'd remember what they were. But I do not receive complaints. There was one that I call now pursuit at length, and it turned out that it was a fallacious, it was not accurate. So, as you know, I don't know how a person writes that up or recaptures it, but I can tell you in general that's been my experience. I can also tell you that if I ever do get complaints, or if Gary gets them or Vicky gets them, it's be our management style to be on those right now.
I want to be very clear. I'm not sure we're talking about personnel complaints at all. But
I'm talking public.
About permit
I'm talking
complaints.
Public complaints.
Kind of thing, yeah.
Public
complaints, though, not to personnel, but to the permit or the permit process and those kind of things.
That's the way I understand your question.
Okay, good.
And may I interject just one more point out just one thing here, that between our two programs, whether I'm confusing Program 1 and Program 2 and the numbers or not, Program 1, which is our survey and services, and it's been the part that we struggled with the most. When you're looking at Program 2 and you're looking at the number of permits that are out there, you know, if you're having complaints from either the permitters or the permittees or other people that may be impacted, it's a little bit easier to track that than when you start working with more esoteric ideas. Like, for example, we have started doing a series of workshops. We've done them on the coast. We've done them for geologic information. We introduce these workshops, and they're not workshops that are only for professionals. But these are open to anyone in the area that would be impacted by the workshop. We think they're a great idea, and it seems like we have a lot of enthusiasm back, but we have not really determined how's the best way to measure if that is an effective way of educating the public and actually reaching our goal audiences. And this is the part we're struggling with now, and it may be a part that I will not be able to come back to you tomorrow or in a few days or a month and give you I could give you a direct answer, but maybe not a direct number of how effective that is.
Representative Morgan.
So when you, in your graphing of the landslide characterizations, I'm looking at here on page 7, and mm-hmm. I think the one before that, the tsunami characterization, the delineate part of it is where you have actually gone through and mapped the areas where the issue is most prevalent. Is that correct?
That's correct, Representative.
And then the risk reduction part of it is where you've gone through and attempted to educate the public about the issues.
John wants to.
This is a difficult one, Representative Morgan and Chair. It is the mitigation part of that is whether we can say yes or no. The community has done something reasonable and meaningful within their bounds with this problem, and that doesn't mean that we got them to do it. It could very well mean that they did something reasonable under Goal 7 or
so,
LCDC.
But when you say reasonable, you mean reasonable in their ability to respond to the danger that you've delineated?
Reasonable, that's more of an emergency management issue, is to respond to it. What we're after is, have they done something somewhat preventative in advance? Example, in 1981-82, we determined that in the community of the Dalles, there was $150 million of public property and real estate threatened by landsliding over 50 city blocks. And we worked with, there was a lot of federal money around in those days. We worked with the community and helped them to identify a source of funding to go in and decide what they could do to stop this. Now, I'm quick to add that the city planner was fired the day he signed a contract with our department. But we moved ahead anyway, and there was a study done, and some wells were drilled, and they've been dewatering that slide ever since, and they fixed it. This is an example of fixing something before it gets any worse. one of our technical letters is in your packet under what I believe is tab 10. So that's an example of somebody doing something in advance of a slide.
So then, if you're totaling up where you're going to be in relation to your performance measure, do you say that you've accomplished your goal when you've identified a possible scenario for a local jurisdiction to go to, or do you say you've accomplished your goal when the local jurisdiction actually accomplishes that?
The mitigation has not occurred until after something has been done.
Okay.
I would hasten to add, we do not tell them what to do. For any particular type of landslide situation, there's always a range of options as to what is reasonably effective. And all we ask when we talk to building codes or to the planner or to the city people or to our LCDC contact on this and buyer, when we talk to these people and say, has this community done something? We're not going to second guess what they did. If we think that technically, yeah, that'll work, then we'll count that as a win.
But we can be assured when we look at which way the line is going, that a rising line means that mitigation has actually been accomplished.
Yes.
Thank you.
John, I have to ask you, the planner in the Dalles that got fired on the days, was that because he signed the contract?
It's because he mentioned the subject in a public meeting.
Representative Krager had a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. John, it looks to me like, you know, we've been talking a lot here, but you're in the information business and education business. You're not in the regulatory business. Is that fair to say?
On Program 1, we basically are not in the regulatory business.
And I look at that, and I think the public might disagree with the science or maybe disagree with the risk, but you're just telling them what you believe it to be.
Representative Krieger, Mr. Chair, yes, I would go on to say that when we do, quote, believe something to be risk, it is only after proper scientific investigation and after peer review by somebody outside the department and after thorough analysis. We are not out there waving our arms. But when we state that there's a geologic hazard of significance enough to a city that it should do something about it, it's probably true.
And I would like to if I may, interject a little comment here about the difference between geologic hazard and assessing risk. And and I'm sure you're all aware of that there's a huge difference between knowing that there's a, for example, a landslide on a steep slope, which is a geologic hazard or the potential of that hazard, and whether or not there's any risk to anyone or any property, depending on what's sitting along that slope or at the bottom of the slope. And in many times, we are in the business of giving unbiased geologic information about what that hazard is, and we are not particularly in the business of telling someone, land use folks, cities, communities, what their risk is. That's where we work with them, or that's where we turn that information over to people and they determine their risk. It's very important to that we do not want to get into that business. And again, as we're saying, we do have two programs, and Program 1 is the geologic and services, and Program 2 does have, you know, when we're looking at our mine land reclamation, then we are looking at something that is more regulatory.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Dukes.
You don't want to tell them what to do, but it seems to me that you come up short personnel-wise on being able to give them guidance when they ask as well, because they don't have the experts either. They often turn to you as the experts, and it's been one of my frustrations is that we produce the maps and they're excellent, and the community knows they have a problem, and then they need to do something, and they don't always have the personnel to be able to help.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, that's an excellent observation. When I came to the department, the practice was to do the study, print 1,000 copies, ship them to the warehouse, get on to the next study. And under Don Hull, and a lot of people working hard and thinking about this, and our board interacting with us, saying they didn't think that was quite enough. And so the legislature in 1989 and 91 and 93 completely revamped our enabling legislation, filled in their sentence says, basically, when you figured all this out, form partnerships to reduce risk. And with that, we've struggled our way through the 90s through a series of budget cuts. And when I took over, I reorganized once to try to get at this issue, and then last session we were reminded in a friendly way by the chairman of this subcommittee at the time to do it again. We did, and that's the chart you see in front of us. So the chart has a section there for public education, and we use that for technology transfer and trying to get information to people. And the people on there that have orange are people that bow to the contractor because they're on soft money. So there's not a lot. In fact, all of the people in orange are on soft money. Non-general fund. I was told the other day that general fund was also soft, so let me be specific that they're on non-general fund. So what?
Make sure you say the orange stripes.
Yeah, the orange stripes. The orange stripes. Yeah, that's bad enough as it is. Anyway, so we have people that we're trying to build a capability. Now, the head of the public education section orchestrates workshop, disc, website, publication, phone call, letter, whatever it takes to help. It's her job to kind of manage the orchestration of this to try to get to be as cost-effective as we can. But people are strapped down a little bit on contract work, so they're not always out there talking to the people. In fact, all of those sections, as you can see, they either have a person that's dedicated to as match to a contract or they are a contract, and that gets to the question Representative Johnson asked. I can't bring these people into Portland without laying them all off because they can't get contracts in Portland. They have to be out there close enough to the field where their expertise competes at a national level to do something. And so if I cannot consolidate because these people cannot be moved away from their work, still be competitive. And that's one of the things we struggle with.
I remember having that very discussion 2 years ago when we talked about that.
I thought I had failed to bring it up, but anyway, I'm happy to bring it up again. So we are strapped to the ground in certain ways, but your point to me is crucial. Program one is two things. Getting the information that a geology survey property should do for the reasons I gave earlier to avoid immense costs where there are mistakes that cannot be avoided any other way. Getting the information, but then getting it out to the people that need it, the people, the communities, whatever. One of the tabs, tab 9, talks about our public service delivery system, we try to call it, and also lists those contacts that just happen to be in my computer. And a list runs for 3 pages, and those are people I work with. We have to get the information out to these people and entities, whether they be port districts, cities, or whatever, in a form that they can use. That makes sense, and as Representative Morgan knows, that's not always easy coming out of, for example, the workshop we had in Roseburg on Senate Bill 12. Some people would have considered that workshop criticism, and I should have added that to my list. To me, it was not criticism at all. It was helpful input, so I didn't count that as one of the two critiques. I thought that was a very productive meeting. So that's half of our program is getting the information out to people, the way they can use it.
I want to carry this along today to get the information out and maybe give you some direction for information we'd like for tomorrow. I'm told that we don't have any sign up for public comment today, but we are expecting some tomorrow, and so I think we probably need to allow for a minimum of a half hour, and probably closer to an hour tomorrow. But I would ask you as one issue, as we go through our budget program, again, we're going to come back to priorities, but programs which you've started here, which it might be prudent to delay during this budget time, then pick it up again at the next biennium and try to forward, just so that we have the options to, and your input to have a better sense of what would be appropriate, and maybe, I don't know if you have anything that would be appropriate to do that, but my guess is that to do the things we need to do and balance the budget and get out of this building in the next 6 months or so, that we're going to have to do some pretty creative things like that. It's going to be disappointing to a lot of people, and because we have helped set that direction and in many cases probably put mandates on departments. But the situation we're in, we're simply going to have to take a very critical look at some of the things we've asked departments to do and maybe back off for a while. So I'd appreciate your input on that. And Vicki, why don't you go ahead and go on with your presentation, and we've got about 45 minutes left today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I have covered all the main areas. We could look at there. If you look at pages 8 in the handout that I gave, pages 8 and 9, which are the geologic data for local and for regional problem solving, I could talk just a minute about those. Although we have covered those kind in different directions. And again, what we're looking at now are tracking our, when we say geologic data for local problem solving, what we started out with a goal for this was just how much of the state could we actually map at a 1 to 24,000, which is a 7.5-minute quadrangle. And in order to do that, the first thing we did internally was to prioritize locations around the state that would be the most important to begin that mapping process. You can understand that it would be a little bit more important to have a good map. And I'll pick on Eastern Oregon because I'm quite fond of Eastern Oregon, having just moved there from Baker City. So I think that it's more important to map the quadrangles where Pendleton and the town of Mission are than to map some of the fields or the large wheat fields around there, because those are urban areas. And, of course, we've carried that through to all the urban areas, even over here on the west side. We do map over here as well. What we have learned as we began this local problem-solving mapping is that it was also very important, and I said this before, to look at more regional problems, and that's what you see on the next page, are the maps that we compile at a 1 to 100 scale. In order to do those compilations, we have to have the more local information, or we may have to be able to go out and find other people or other areas or other entities that have mapped those, and we can compile that information. What we've learned over the last few years is that it's not as important to map these 1 to 100 maps in big 1 to 100 rectangles that are laid out in your map as you look at maps, but again, to look at a more geographic, a more important way of breaking these maps up are geographically, and that is where we began mapping our compilation maps under the watersheds. We've just completed the Upper Grand Ronde River Watershed Basin Study, and we're in the midst of the Umatilla River Watershed Basin Study now. These larger compilation regional maps are more important because they cover an area that we have, by our board, been mandated to look at, and that's both surface and groundwater issues, how geology can help in solving those issues. And so we have revamped our mapping to accommodate those particular strategies now.
First, I want to, if I could, Representative Morgan. All of our maps here are showing to either 2000 or 2001. Could you come back tomorrow with showing what happened 2001, 2003, as well as maybe project what you hope to accomplish in these areas for the coming biennium too?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to bring that, to further that. And
soon we're seeing more and more progress, but in some of these categories, It looks like it leveled off.
Well, and that's a very good point, and that may be exactly what you'll see with this 1 to 100 compilation. I know that we will have completed at least one more map out of that. And for the compilation maps, those are usually a 5-year turnaround. And so sometimes you have a leveling off because you're still gathering the higher resolution information you need to actually complete that project. So it doesn't always track immediately up, and it won't track exactly following the one to 24,000 ones.
Representative Mark.
A couple of questions. In relation to the maps that are released digitally rather than paper, where are you at right now in the percentage of them? Are you issuing more digital ones than paper ones at this point in time?
Representative Morgan, members of the committee, all of our new publications are digital publications. We are also in the process. We received some monies over the last 2 years to scan our older publications, which were all paper publications, so that they will be within the next year available as electronic files. They will not all be digitized, but they'll be electronic files. But we are in the digital world now, so all of our maps and all of our publications come out as a digital product.
So where can you give us an idea of where the field is in terms of people out in the real world being able to receive the digital data and use it?
Representative Morgan, members of the committee, that's an excellent question, and it's one we struggle with. I'm not even going to hazard a percentage or number there, except to say that when we do two things. When we issue a digital map, which means you actually buy your information on a CD-ROM, We have it in several different forms, so you don't have to be a geologist or a geographic information system person to be able to look at that. You do need to have a computer, and yet you can open it up in what we call a PDF form, or you're just looking at the picture of that map. We also still will plot on demand. If someone is willing to pay for the time and the paper and everything, we still have the capability of doing that. And so we do offer that for our products.
But everybody that has the working capacity inside the computer can just open them as PDF maps and look at them.
That is correct.
A PDF file.
A PDF file. And if they have the capability, if they have geographic information system software, then they can open up all these individual layers and the polygons and get into it and actually work as a spatial data system. And all of the products that we sell on the CD have the text that go with them. They have all the data that's behind that. Everything is packaged on that CD.
Will you indulge me one more time?
One more time.
What are the pathways for people to get this information? You're talking about a CD-ROM. So do they call you up and they say, I want something that shows me this particular area? Or do you have you just give them a CD-ROM with everything on it? How do they get it?
Well, Representative Morgan, the CD is our publication. So, for example, if we had recently released one of our GMS Geographic Map Series maps, for example, let me just look and see what's the last thing in our publication here. If we had a map of the Imbler Quadrangle, which is, again, on the eastern side, that's one of the latest maps that we released. That CD-ROM will have everything that you would have if you bought the map as a rolled-up map and the text that went with that. Excuse me? Okay, John has some insight also on this as well.
I think I know what you're after. We have a publication list, and it's broken down by
subject. That's on your website, too.
Yes. It's broken down by subject, but also location. So if you're Douglas County and you want to know what Dogami has, you either go to our website or get a copy of this. foot of the park that's on county, look up Douglas County, you'll see what we have. Is that, I think that's what you're after.
Well, I'm interested in the fact that, so do people have to get on your web and email you or call you up and say, send me the CD-ROM, or can they download the stuff?
Thank you. We are not at that particular level with our website at this point, and so the CD would have to be purchased the same as if you came and purchased a map, which means you can call or you can email, you can go to our information center, the Nature of the Northwest, or you can go to one of the field offices that all have them available. No, we are not at the level where we have the ability to download from our website. And part of the you can order some of these from the website from the Nature of the Northwest, but again, it's an order. I mean, you have to order it. We our internal website, to be able to maintain a website where you're having downloadable information like that, we frankly don't have the personnel to keep that website going like that. That we have a webmeister or webmaster, but we do not have someone that's a 24-hour person on that.
And colleagues, we might want to, and maybe you haven't had a response to this, but we did start and fund the Natural Resource Institute last session, and it was the vision I saw, unless I was inaccurate on this, was that this kind of information would all at some point end up at the Natural Resource Institute. So someone could log on there and pick it up and get the feedback, whether it was water rights, water resources, land use, soil types, including your information as well. So I don't know if obviously we're not to that point yet, but I think that's where the state of Oregon as a whole should at some point end up. I want to go to Representative Johnson first. And then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being out of the room, and you may have answered this. Do the fees you charge for all of these data sets cover the cost of preparing them?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, depends on the definition of prepare. If the intent here is to cover all the printing costs, handling costs, postage costs, lighting, and part of the rent, then the answer is yes. If the intent is to cover the cost of the professionals doing the work out in the field, that's either handled by contract or, through some kind of funding we get through contract, or it's handled by the person we use to leverage the contract.
Contracts with whom, Mr. Bully? I don't understand
As you're out of the room, one of the subjects I got into was every position you see on the organization chart to my left that has an orange stripe on it. Funded with something other than general fund.
And I don't repeat it. I don't want to take that.
And we compete for contracts for half our staff on a competitive basis nationally at all times.
Thank you. Okay.
One of the things about pricing is that if we price something a little bit too high, the guy across the street under public information rights is going to take it and reproduce it on his computer and sell it for less than we do. So it's not possible to take one of our documents and jack up a real high price because somebody else will simply get a copy of it and sell it for less. And that's fine. We're supposed to be producing information for the public good. And we have had publications in the past where another person has taken them on and reproduced them. We also have restrictions in a variety of legislation and executive orders that talk about moving towards a target of providing information for free over the web. We've been part of those discussions, and we have our own statutory limitations that say our job is to put information out on the street for the public good and not to charge more than what is reasonable for reproduction and publication.
Okay. Ricky, could you move ahead here, and then we'll leave time for Lisa to give her report.
Thank you. The final internal goal, which is part of our mineral assessments and minerals and groundwater geology, and that's page 10, and it's the final part of goal 4, and I'll just quickly go over that. That is the tracking of the percent mineral resources studies completed, and it covers a whole variety of mineral resources. For example, metallic, GIS layer, industrial minerals, aggregate minerals, and also our oil and gas, geothermal, and groundwater. And if you'll notice, groundwater is the very last of the tracking that we have there. They're the little pyramids at the bottom, and that really we didn't start anything in there until 1990 and 1995, and that is when we really started a more concerted effort on looking at subsurface geology and some of the groundwater issues that are now very prevalent in parts of the state.
But we have a question for Representative Morgan.
Well, half of it got answered when I read the footnote, because I was curious about, who was doing all this groundwater studying, whether you were duplicating efforts that were going on in other parts of the at the Water Resources Department. And I had the same issue with a GIS layer on the top graph. Is that actually coming out of somewhere else?
Oh, okay.
Let me handle this, Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan. These are good questions. On the groundwater issue, the way we put it is we'll count the rocks and they count the water. And our role is to help characterize the geology, the rocks, which kind of tell the water where to go. And then that helps the Water Resources Department do their job. They have a member on our MAP Advisory Committee. We have made formal presentations before their board. We've made it very clear that we have absolutely no intention of data collection for the water itself, but merely the production of the maps
that they use
to help them understand how the water is moving.
Are you then kind of merging their information about where water is with your information about where the rocks are?
They would do the merging. What we're doing is producing good geology maps that show the different characteristics of the rocks so that they can better interpret, what they're finding in terms of what the water is. And they use our maps. This is the model that's been used in other states and also at the national levels that the geology departments can be of great value and help to solving water problems if they'll start directing their mapping into areas where there are water problems. But at the same time, we have absolutely no interest or desire or intent in touching the water data itself. And this is something, water modeling is a universe unto itself, and we're quite busy just handling the geology.
Well, and again, I think it gets back to the point that Senator Meserle had about the Natural Resource Institute being a place where you could select a point on the Earth's surface and then go down through all the data layers and find out what's known and not known about that particular place.
Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, I see that eventually happening, actually, and we're talking to all the right people on that, and there are a variety of conversations that I could reproduce here, but they're quite lengthy. Very, very briefly, we do have this GIS thing on the top graph that you mentioned. In the natural resource realm of state government, we, of course, have the Oregon Geographic Information Council. I'm on that board. And then we have a variety of agencies out there, each with their own assigned thematic layer. And our layer is the geology and the minerals. It's our responsibility to get that stuff into the state system. So when we say GIS, we're talking about our particular assigned responsibility, and not replicating or reproducing what other people are doing with those people and trying to get them our data. In the wonders of the budget process, it turns out that if within DAS, the Oregon Geographic Information System has funded its next component for data layers, that next layer is the geoscience layer. And we've been chairing the committee with them on the development of what the most needed data layers are. So that, in fact, was one of our option packages. We put it in there for no other reason but to get it on the radar screen within DAS during the budget process and to say to them that that's a piece of their budget that we're looking at, because we've been running that committee now for about 6 months to a year. And that's how that relates to our department this time around.
I don't know where you are in your presentation, Vicki. Are we going to discuss Program 2 today, too, or is your intention?
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
I believe that I've finished with all of these, and I hope if there's any other questions that you would like to ask about the performance measures or benchmarks or our way of evaluating our work and productivity, we'd love to answer them at this point. If not, we'll turn it over to Gary to talk about program two.
I want to make it clear that we would like to see these graphs and the information extended on into 2003 or see where we're at today. And also, we're very interested in seeing your priorities presented to us tomorrow. As we said earlier, either way we go, whether we have to make further reductions or if we have more revenue than what we anticipated and can do add backs, we'd like your priorities on that. So.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we'll certainly be ready for that discussion. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to make very brief comments about Program 2, and then Gary's going to invite you to a smorgasbord, whatever kind of presentation you would like. I would present the insight I have is that everything that's green there is Program 2, and that's mine and reclamation, oil, gas, and geothermal, reclamation, spacing, revenue sharing, all of the things that go with oil and gas. Program 2 in this department is analogous to Fish and Wildlife, to the Fish and Wildlife Department, or to Forestry, to the Forest Department, whatever, or to fill and removal to state lands. Program 2 is funded entirely with non-general funds. It is funded probably 90% or 95% with fees from the industry. The dollars that have been provided by that are not adequate to support the authorized positions. So Gary's group has moved into competitive grants and tried to get funding in that very narrow slice of money where the requirements of the funding source are so similar to what we might do otherwise on complex problem solving that it makes sense to call in some of those contracts and get some of that money. I don't think there's another regulatory program in the state that does that to support its staff. They've been very good at it, and we're moving into some of the really tough issues for the state, such as how do you handle Endangered Species Act on floodplains? And we've begun discussions there with our board and they also with the industry. So I'd like to ask Gary to come up here. And it's an area we can talk about so many things. He's going to say a few introductory comments and then let you determine which direction he goes.
John, I have to ask you first, what do you mean by, from your department's perspective, Endangered Species Act on floodplains? That looks like a water issue. How does that relate to your department?
Endangered Species Act, go where the attorneys go, and they like to look at pits once in a while. So Gary will probably give a better answer than I would on that. And
I hope I do.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Boy, he sure shifted that one quick.
Yeah, I may have misunderstood something John just said. You're out applying for grants to fund your programs? I didn't misunderstand. It's sort of like the watershed councils. You just apply and hope for the best?
Mr. Chair, maybe give me a shot at this one, please. For the record, my name is Gary Lynch, Assistant Director of Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, Mine Land Reclamation Regulation Program. We added an R in the last biennium. And Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, you're right. And ever since 1997, when I've come and testified before this committee, we made it clear that the mining industry does not pay for the entire program. And we knew that in 1997 when we got our last fee increase. That's been okay because we are competitive we have a very competent field staff. I don't say that lightly, and I mean every word of it. And that staff not only regulates the 870 some mine permits we have on a monthly basis, the oil and gas and geothermal activity that we have, but in order to make ends meet since 1997, we have gone out and looked for grants and competitively sought those grants and been somewhat successful, in receiving those grants, and those grants allow us to do the work that I think is very beneficial to this state from the standpoint of the mining industry and the oil and gas industry tend to polarize people. Some people really like it and other people really hate it, and we have to strike that balance that says we not only do the permitting, but we're staying at the cutting edge of where the industry needs to go and where the citizens and the wildlife and the fish need protection. And it's a balancing act, and information allows us to solve that equation. Since 97, we've received an EPA grant that's come and gone. We've received a couple of grants from the Forest Service that have come and gone. We worked with the Department of Environmental Quality, and in order to a very successful streamlining experiment, we went to the Department of Environmental Quality, said, look, we'll take over the general stormwater permitting at mine sites for 75% of the revenue that those permits derive. And we doubled the number of permits in 2 years, which I think provided both protection and we know the mining community was now dealing with one agency versus two. Very successful program. We then, and this is where we get into the other part of the question of, well, the floodplain and endangered species. Well, the floodplain is inextricably linked to our rivers and streams. That is not only where the recharge happens, it's also where, in times like this, we see water moving onto the floodplain in large amounts. And what we recognized was that they are inextricably linked. And if we're going to continue to have floodplain mining, which certainly the industry wants to do and we think the public wants in terms of they want good roads, they want the construction materials that aggregates produce, then we have to find a way different than the state of Washington did to see if we can make that happen. And that's where those grants have been very beneficial to us, and we took it on. We learned as much as we could about this issue. I would say that we rank nationally in our understanding of the dynamics of the floodplain and the river systems. We do believe there is a need for a river geologist, fluvial geomorphologist is the term, but that one doesn't little too wordy. And that's not going to happen right now, but we have great on-the-job training skills in this area. And what we're seeing is we can have our cake and eat it too. There are, if you mine on the floodplain in a certain way that allows that river to have some of that area when we're done or when the mining company is done, we start to develop the overflow channels and the habitat that the juvenile salmon need in high water. And by far the most successful version of that is one that Representative Morgan has witnessed down on the Rogue River that John referred to earlier in his testimony, where a reach of the Rogue River, if I could back up a second, we've had a long history of mining in this state. It didn't just start in 1972 when we got the Mine Land Reclamation Act. It had been going on for years, and in that area we had seen a number of pits because the county, understandably so, had clustered the land use mining zoning for a relatively small area along the road. That's where the gravels were. It made good sense at the time. We look back at that, we could say, well, it was a good decision or bad, but it was a decision that was made. We didn't have any, there was no regulatory model that allowed us to deal with the potential impacts of what might happen there. Last year, in a very dry year, the bank between the first pit that would have started the domino effect in capturing about four, lost 15 feet, so we went from 60 feet to 45 feet, and it may have been 75 to 60, I forget which. Very low water year. This year, and we'll never be able to prove this, but at considering the flows we just had, which were up at 27,000 CFS compared to 3,000, nothing happened. Something did happen. A great stakeholders group got together that was put together by this agency, but along with the Rogue Aggregates, Harry and David's Orchards, private landowners, and literally stabilized that bank, but at the same time created new spawning areas along this reach of river. So we deal with not only new permits, but the legacy of our mining practices in the past that weren't necessarily thought out well by today's standards, but were fine back then.
Representative Morgan.
Well, I got to find out. What happened with that one raceway where it cuts into that old slough when it was high water? Did that hold?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morgan, did we have some very, I think, illustrative pictures of what's about to happen, though, if we don't get that fixed soon. And what the representative refers to in the 96-97 floods, which triggered, really was the big trigger in us saying, we better start doing something, and we're going to see a number of these problems. In a 96-97, one of these pits was captured. And Kelly Slough, this overflow area that is, we have just put in a grant today with OWEB to fix phase three, was flooded in this last event and started to give. Now, we had in the previous year put a layer of rock over that, and it's holding so far. We are not far from losing that, and we'll see. We hope it's going to make it through this year, but that area upstream of that where those barbs went in, I am convinced it would have gone. We had direct impingement on that bank. The technical fix we and these stakeholders put in moved the high velocity flows back from that bank and let them go towards the other side, which is just fine. So it's acting very much like the normal dynamic system that it's supposed to be, only we've said to the river, don't go any further this way, and it's worked out very well.
The high level look at this is that there's all these mined out pits that are just inside the bank of the river. And the current of the river is breaking down the separation between the river flow and these pits. And so if it breaks through in a significant way, it's going to change the course of the river and flood a whole bunch of land.
And that's been very, I mean, we are convinced that is, I mean, it, like I said, it's handling flows far greater than we've seen since, other than the 96-97.
Gary, I want clarification, yeah. Though. You keep saying we. Is the department or the state of Oregon responsible for maintaining this? And then you also mentioned stakeholders.
Mr. Chairman, that's where the regulatory model starts to break down when you get to restoration efforts. There is nothing to force that particular. In my estimation, there was nothing that was going to force anybody to do anything down there. And yet we knew there was a problem. And I really think the strength of our program is that we can work with all sectors. And we did down there, and it was very successful. And that's what we do very well. We go to the field. We can speak the jargon of the miner. We understand the needs of the natural resources and the fish and wildlife. And we become the translator to produce a field-based solution. And that's what we go to the field. In the last biennium, it'll project out for the 2 years 1,400 times with 4.5 field people. And a lot of agencies, a lot of people say, how do you do that? Well, because they don't have real good family lives is about the only thing I can come up with. But no, that's not fair. They're very dedicated people that go to the field, and that's where we do our work. That's the importance of keeping us in the field. It truly is. That is where the problems are solved. That's why we have field solutions instead of legal solutions.
Representative Johnson.
That's a perfect segue into my question. You talk about the premium that your agency confers, the added value to the industry, that you're the interface between many people's antagonism towards mining and the need for these extractive industries. You've got an industry that does not have a spotless track record and has left as a legacy to the citizens of Oregon the kind of mess that you're talking about. My question is, other than a very powerful lobby, why isn't there a demand to have the industry carry their own weight and to have these programs that confer this added value to them? Why shouldn't they want to step up with a little nudging and pay for it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, that is a legitimate question. However, the regulatory process of the state of Oregon said first of all, if it was mined prior to 72, there was no responsibility for them to do anything other than mine the rock. There was no reclamation responsibility. Two, clearly, the permits we wrote in 1972 and 1975 back then, they were adequate for the time based on the scope of what we understood was what we're supposed to do. Since then, our permits are far more exacting and do prevent that kind of thing from happening. But this legacy issue of who should pay for it, I'm not here to speak for the aggregate industry. They speak for themselves. But from a natural resource manager's standpoint, we do run the face of we made decisions 30 years ago that
oftentimes don't hold up well to the test of time. And the question is, can we fix those now? And in fairness to the industry down in the Rogue, they did really step up. Rogue Aggregates contributed a sizable amount, close to $200,000 of their own cash to run the river model and all that. So in that case, I think we're looking at a situation where they did. Does every company out there have that same ethic? It's not, probably not. But to me, the secret of this is my personal opinion, if we're going to fix these legacy-type problems, that was the most powerful stakeholder group I've ever seen. We had the Rogue River Fly Fishers Association holding hands with Harry and David Orchards, holding hands with Rogue Aggregates, holding hands with the federal agencies. There was some blood and guts left on the floor, but we'd pick it up and we'd start again. And it was an exacting process over 2 years that had a very, very solid result for the state of Oregon and everybody. So in that case, I think the industry did pick up their share. I think one of our real values is that we can help convince them that there's something to do here, and that if it's not done together, what did somebody once said, if we don't hang together, we'll hang separately.
Well, I just would like to give the opportunity for the industry to be a full partner and to recognize the value added that you confer, and to see that has an economic benefit to them as an inducement to step up.
And I think we've got a fee bill that's going to be considered that will do that to some extent.
Mr. Chairman, I hope so.
Mr. Chair, if I
we have a question from Senator Duke.
Yeah, I'm kind of tagging on what Representative Johnson was saying. If fees aren't covering Program 2, how do you do long-term planning if you're doing if you're applying from competitive grants? If you have an area that you know really needs attention, but you got to go find a grant for it, in terms of long-range geologic hazard planning, it just seems like it's non-existent to any reasonable degree. If you got to go out and get competitive grants, I guess I've been at this a long time, but I don't think I've ever heard of a state agency that relied for part of its regularly for part of its budget on competitive grants from other organizations.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, it would be great to have us totally funded and be allowed to do all that research. And it's not that we haven't made that point, but at the same time, and I think people look at me funny when I say this, I think it's the hardest working program in state government, and I really believe that. And that may not be a sufficient answer, but and we'll continue to work hard.
Representatives, we'll come to you, but I want to state that at 3 o'clock I have to leave, and I know Representative Morgan has to leave, so we need to tie together and make sure that everyone is on the same page.
Can you schedule tomorrow?
Yes, we are tomorrow, but I want to make sure that the department is clear on what kind of information we want from them.
I'll be quick. Senator Duke's concern concerns me. I happen to come from the only county that does not participate in Dope Gummy, and it has been a hornet's nest of litigation and bad feelings. And what disturbs me is if you got dumped Columbia County day after tomorrow, how badly that would disrupt the fragile balance that you have predicated the existence of Program 2 on. At Mr. Bolio's request, I have a call into our county council to try to get some idea of what their current status is. But I think it should not go unnoticed that to get handed one of the most contentious counties in Oregon and say, fix this inside your existing resources, that might just swamp the boat.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it's not that we haven't had the same concerns, and so one of the things we've done over the last 2 years is gone to work with Columbia County, and it's not our position to say they should or shouldn't have it. We'll work with them whatever way they want. What we did is we offered up our aerial photography services, which are paid for when we found a way to work smarter, not harder, when we took over the stormwater program. So we added an aerial photography program. We check with every operator to make sure it's okay that we fly their site. And we did that for Columbia County in hopes that some of these horrible boundary issues that they face up there could be resolved. In addition, I've talked with Carla Cudmore and I forget the name of the county council.
John Knight.
John Knight, and that if they thought it was in their interest, we'd come up there on a basis where we shared our expertise with them so they could work through that. But you're right. If that program suddenly came in, and first of all, there are legal problems with it because we don't have any new grandfathered sites. The 99 session, we get rid of those, and there's enough so we'd be accepted. I don't know how you do that. And so one of my recommendations to anybody who would listen would be that that statutorily we take care of that before it does happen, because hopefully I'm not going to be here in 10 years. Nothing against the state of Oregon, but you know, eventually, I would say in the next 10 years, there's a strong likelihood we'll see that program in Doggany.
Senator Dukes is my senator, and I think probably we ought to talk to you about maybe finding a statutory remedy before you get handed that hornet's nest.
Okay.
But to think that they're going to fund it off of grants, I'm sorry.
we're going to deal with that this session, right?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative.
And the fee bill, okay.
And those fees would help. And I've always told, and I tell my staff this, and I'll tell this group, and it's sincere as I'm sitting here. I've always felt I had an easy job here because I've never done anything more than explain what my staff does, and I'm dead honest. And they work really hard. They are concerned, and so we make things work. And you know, we prioritize on a monthly basis. What are we going to do this month? Price of gold is now $370. And Eastern Oregon is suddenly, you know, now we want to have some gold mining. And I'm sitting there going, okay, how do we do this? But, you know, those are people who care and will find a way.
I thought you were going to work on the weekends and staked out some claims.
You'd be amazed at how many inspections are done on Sunday by my
staff. Any chance we own any of those?
Well, actually, a portion of one.
Well, we're just about out of time, but I want to make it very clear that we need to talk about vacancies tomorrow, management staff ratios. Again, we need to talk about the prioritized list, program comparison with our measures and co-chairs, and again, same as priorities, list on reductions, depending what would happen with funding levels. And really, I really do want to try to hold an hour for public comment because I'm expecting a considerable amount of public comment. So that leaves us an hour for you to make these presentations.
Reclass is on there too, isn't it?
Pardon me?
Reclassifications are on there too, aren't they? I think they didn't.
That would
add those to the list?
Are there? Yes.
I believe they were added to the list.
Right, and that would be part of the vacancy report.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the list you just run through, we have the material. Okay. It's in the packets. And or if maybe it isn't through oversight, but we have all of that. If I could just make one very brief comment with regard to Program 1, the challenges that have been belabored here for Program 2 also apply to Program 1 to some extent. I believe it is very, very healthy for a survey to attract some of its funding from outside sources. The partnerships and everything else are just immeasurably of great value. If you'll just, when you're doing your homework tonight, go to tab 5, you'll find the revenue history of the department, and in the right-hand column it tells and demonstrates that we have gone beyond optimal in Program 1 as well for the attractive competitive outside grants.
Okay, thank you very much. With that, I'll adjourn the public hearing and adjourn the meeting.